So far in these meetings, and you have stuck with me so loyally, I am so proud of you all for coming to this math class. I didn't know people voluntarily came to math class, but I am so proud of you all. We've talked about math, and we've talked about the discovery of numbers. We talked about the discovery of the language of mathematics that we use today. We learned that there actually are a lot of different languages in mathematics, and there are different ways of looking at numbers. But today we're going to focus more on teaching math effectively. What does effective math teaching look like? I can't tell you how badly I've dreaded this class. I have so many notes, and I've studied so hard. But when I go to teach math on a board, my mind goes blank. My students love this fact about me, and they help me teach math. In fact, they do a better job at teaching math than I do. I sort of direct them in the general direction, and they sort of do it. So I really feel very vulnerable before you today, because I think probably any of you could come up here and teach this math better than I can. But I have good techniques. I'll say it that way. When it comes right down to the teaching part, I forget. My mind is blank. But I have good techniques, I think. So let's a few little thoughts here before we start. I believe that unless we get our students to see beyond their math books into real life, unless we get them to use their math in real life, we haven't taught them math. We want them to see the formula and the fractions, etc., etc., as useful things they will need to live a full life. Also help them understand how handicapped they will be without a good working knowledge of math. So my dad and my uncle were trying to buy this piece of timber to log, and this piece of timber was shaped like a trap. You guys can help me out here. Parallelogram, right? So it's a parallelogram, and my uncle was absolutely positive that all you did to find the area of a parallelogram is go like the length of one side times the length of the other side. Well, you know what? You don't do that. It's the height times the length, right? You don't do. Very simple. He should have learned that. And there was a heated debate, of which my dad was on the other side of the debate and said, no, it's the height times the. And anyway, upshot of it is finally my dad did convince him that the area of a parallelogram is a little different, and saved him thousands and thousands of dollars for buying the timber in this. I mean, my uncle thought it would be a lot more land than this. It was like maybe a 10 or 15 acre difference. So it has real life consequences. Help your students see that. Remember, math is a language. First of all, math is a language. It's not just one and two. It's an apple or two pies, or it's a language. Math is also a sense. And I didn't know this until I did a lot of studying. You know, we have a sense of balance. We have a sense of humor. We have a sense of rhythm. And we also have a sense of math to more or less degrees. And it's a sense that you can develop. When we develop our sense of math, we discover new ways of seeing problems and detecting patterns in the world around us. In the beautiful, absolutely random-looking creation, we see patterns. We see threads, just like a brother showed us this morning. Pi shows up in the formula for the randomness of throwing little matchsticks on the floor. How can that be a thread in this? And it happens again and again. The fingerprints of God, relationships between objects, logical connections. We get this sense of math. So, I've said this before, and things like, you know, I'm just not a math person. I've always struggled with math. I don't do math. I'm just not a math person. But how does this sound? You know, seeing has always been a struggle for me. I guess I'm just not a seeing kind of person. I guess I'll just not see. What a waste of time. I'm not good at it. I might as well stop. We should all do that. You know, we see some more and some less. Some of us don't see well. Some see very well. But we don't. We see the best we can. We go and get therapy. We get glasses. And we see absolutely the best that we can. And I think that would be a much better analogy for how we're supposed to be treating our math skills. Instead of saying, I'm just not a math person. No, I'm a math person. I just have to try, I mean, I'm going to do the best I can with what I've got and try to develop it. We try to see the very best we can. Let's try to do math and to experience math the best we can, this language of math. So I have some points here I want to talk about teaching, but before I start, I have this just little insert I want to put here. When I went to school a number of years ago, our teachers thought that counting on your fingers was not a good idea. Somehow counting on your fingers will destroy some delicate part of the math in your brain. Fingers, no. In your mind, oh, help us. 7 plus 7. I wish I lost them in my notes, but I wish I had all the studies that I found on counting on your fingers. They say when you count on your fingers in the lower grades, like your whole brain lights up with the action of counting on your fingers with math. It helps you remember and feel and understand numbers that you're doing. It doesn't do damage. It helps a lot of things. It helps translate numbers into real things, and it's especially effective if they count on their fingers when they can't see them. Like if they hold their fingers underneath their desks and count on them, they found that is one of the very best ways to help them remember numbers. So use objects and things, but let them count on their fingers. I just wish some of my old teachers would be here. Let me count on my fingers! Anyway, so you may argue with me on that. There may be other ways of looking at it. I don't know. But in my mind, let them count on their fingers. And, you know, eventually they're not going to be able to do that. I mean, 9 times 9 is really hard to do on your fingers. I've been there and done that. And you know what? It's hard. So you learn other ways. But in the beginning, to help them visualize and understand numbers and things, let them count on their fingers. So I have here 5 points. And they are not original with me. I got them from this teacher by the name of Dan Finkel, who is an amazing math teacher. I wish I could learn math from David Finkel. I mean, Dan Finkel. What did I say David for? Dan Finkel. These are his points. I added some other things in here, but they're amazing and wonderful points for teaching math. The first thing, his first point on teaching math, is when you're teaching mathematics, start with a question. And I don't know how many math classes I have taught where I started with the answer. I sit down and I say, you know what, children, today we're going to learn how to divide fractions. And this is how you do it. Boom, boom, boom. We're done. You know what? 5 minutes later, I'm on to the next class. And you know what? They got it. They sort of did their thing. But they didn't really learn it. You know, later on, we learned it a little better. Start with a question. And I'm sure probably some of you have done this. So a question a little bit more like this. So I have 5 apples. And I would like to give each of my friends a half of an apple. How many friends do I have? Right? Well, you know what? We can all do that in our heads. And most of your 4th and 5th graders probably can't do it. Oh, by the way, I should give you a little disclaimer. My highest level of math teaching that I've ever done is 5th grade. You know, I did math in school. You know what? I passed. I mean, my report cards say I did. I passed. I know I did. So all of you professionals out there with your 10th grade algebra and 19th grade calculus or whatever happens, you know what? I'm talking more about foundations here. And apply it how you can, but this is foundations. And I've talked to a lot of math teachers in preparation for this class, and they said, Aaron, they said, if we could ask for anything, it would be that our students would come into our classes prepared. Know their math facts, know how basic math is done. Understand what happens when you multiply fractions. Understand what happens when you do these things. Understand how formulas work, because then we can take them and teach them our higher math. And if we get them and they don't know this stuff, it's really hard to reteach them this basic stuff and also teach them the higher math. So this is more of a foundation situation. Interestingly enough, as I read about all these foundations, I understood math a lot better. I don't know how I missed some foundations, but anyway. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but we're going to start with a question, number one. Number two, let the students have time to grapple with the question. And this was a really neat idea to me. So when we just tell them the answer to the question, all they're interested in is memorizing it and going on, right? We got this formula, let's do it. We switch the divisor, no, the dividend. We switch the second one around and dividing fractions and we go on, right? We got the, and it's just a matter of memorizing and moving on. But much better, let them grapple and think and try to find a way themselves. Now, this is a math class. First we ask them a question, we let them grapple with it. But before we go on to the next step, his third point here is remember you are not the answer key. Right? Thank the Lord we're not. Because my students ask me so many questions I didn't know. I mean, I know a lot of things, but with this mathematics business, it was, honestly, truly, it was an exciting journey of discovery for all of us together, because I didn't know. And I could study it and have it all in my mind, and then they would sort of help me relearn it. And I hate to say that, because I am the most stickler for being prepared for classes. Know your material like the back of your hand, and then know it way better than that. But sometimes things don't really stick in your mind, and then you learn it together, and that's really beautiful. Don't feel threatened when you don't know. I don't know, let's find out. Let's do this together. What do you think? How can we get from point A to point B? Let's work our way through this. And it's amazing how your students will rise to the challenge, and you'll do some amazing things together. Remember again, math is a language. In a language, when we don't know the name of something, we try to find out. You know, what is that round thing on the griddle? What do you call that thing? Oh, it's a tortilla. Oh, yeah, tortilla. Tortilla. We know what it is. We just don't know its name, right? We know how we want to divide up these apples between our friends. We just don't know the language to put it into words, right? That's what we're trying to learn, the language to put it into words. Try to get your students to translate their story problems. So story problems are your greatest friend in teaching math. That is what math is all about. I love story problems. And so my student raises his hand, and he's, so Aaron, Mr. Aaron, so I have this story problem. Well, did you read it, number one? Well, no, probably not. Well, so they read it, right? Oh, I bet you divide. Oh, you multiply. So I have this thing, if I go there, you know, obviously first they have to read their story problem, but I love it when they draw their story problems. I'm like, you know what? Let's draw that. No, Mr. M, please, there's so much. No. When I come back, I want to see it all drawn out, just like it is on that story problem. And you know what? They usually never ask me back, because they understand it when they draw it, right? And I come by later, and there's all these little pieces of pizza there, and it's all there. You know what? They understood it. It made perfect sense when they drew it. Help them, because what you're trying to do, you're trying to help them translate these facts that they're learning into an everyday math that they can use, right? Your story problems are your friends, but they're not going to be your friends if you're just translating them for the students. Help them translate them themselves and make it usable. And if you're having a hard time explaining something, let one of your students who understands it give it a shot. Now, I said that yesterday, and I'll say it again. You know what? It's amazing sometimes the shocking language barriers I have with my students. And I'm here, and I'm wrestling with this program, and I kind of am forgetting again. And you know what? Sometimes 2 minutes with the student that got it, and the whole class is like, yeah, we understand now. Let them do it. Let them help you. It helps them put their thoughts into words, and it gets them ready to be the teacher you want them to be someday anyway. It's wonderful. Not knowing is not failure. It's the adventure of finding out together that is fun with math. We're sort of vulnerable together. So mistakes in math are our friends. Maybe they're our best friends. So Jason Moses and some of his colleagues did this study, and they had probes in people's brains, and they had them doing problems, And they found that when somebody was doing a problem and they make a mistake and they realize they made a mistake, almost their whole brain lights up with synapses and things firing, and as your brain tries to figure out what went wrong and how to fix it. When they do a problem and it goes well, very little is going on in their brain, actually, at the end of the day. And it's your greatest learning time is with a mistake and in fixing it. So I've been trying to learn to build mini barns the last while, and to fund my teaching habit. And mini barns have a lot of math involved with them. And thankfully I get to work with these experienced builders. And they're, of course, very good at building mini barns, and they're quick to point out all my dumb little mistakes. And when they point out the mistakes before I do them, I don't learn a thing. Honestly. I try. Oh, do I ever try. But I don't learn a thing. It's when I have all the sheeting nailed on and I realize something catastrophic is wrong. And I have to pull the sheeting back off and pull the nails out. And have these guys come by and say, wow, you sure messed up a lot of sheeting there. You realize that stuff's like $50 a sheet right now? No, I don't know that. I want to tell you something. My brain, the synapses are firing in there. And I never make that mistake again. Right? Sometimes you just let your students make mistakes. And now, how are you going to fix that mistake? You know, something went wrong here in this math, but how are you going to fix it? Learning, my friends, is going on in their brains. And when we take away the struggle, when we try to pull the sheeting off for them ourselves, they don't get the learning, right? Let them suffer. No. Let them learn, you know? You know what? That's how it works with us. Even as teachers, we learn through our mistakes so much. And remember to work together to find answers. Make it a journey. Make it an exciting journey to somehow find our way through this story problem. Anyway, one of the most useful things about math is a lot of it can be done visually, shown visually, demonstrated. You can cut the label off the pork and bean can like Jonathan Erb did down there this morning to show the surface area of a cylinder. So much of it can be demonstrated. Do those things. Make it real. Make it hands-on. I apologize. I had a bunch of things for this class here. Little manipulatives to put on the board. Little magnetic fractions and things like that. Somehow, I lost them. I have no idea how. They're gone into the great blue yonder. But get those things. Especially the little... In teaching fractions, you can buy them on Amazon for a little bit of nothing. They're little, it's magnetic, and you put them together, and your children can handle them and mess with them and understand them and feel them, and fractions become a piece of pie instead of just this one-fourth, the great mystery of one-fourth. No, make it something real, you know? Help them see their math. Okay, so we figured out we're not there at answer key. We're teaching them to wrestle with a problem while we're not the answer key, right? But a little side note here, children don't automatically know how to brainstorm effectively together. When you say, you know what, let's discuss this problem, that's a skill you're going to have to teach them. What does a constructive discussion look like? How can we stay sort of on topic instead of, you know, following these tangents? How can we build on each other's? And you know what? This is a life skill that is one of the greatest things you can teach them, period, in school. Teach them how to brainstorm with each other constructively. Useful life lesson. So we started with a question. We let the students grapple with the question. And while we're doing this, we're not being the answer key, right? Fourth point, say yes to your students' ideas. And sometimes that feels a little dumb when your students say really dumb ideas. But say yes to them, discuss them, demonstrate how or why they will or will not work. Make it hands-on, demonstrate, show them, make them understand that there are maybe there are a few dumb answers. But try to help them not give dumb answers, but then also, because guess what? There are more ways than one to skin a cat. There are more ways to this answer than we think sometimes. And maybe what we've thought of isn't the only right way. And then this last one. Number 5, be willing to play. And this is such an outrageous thought in my mind when it comes to mathematics that I just love it. It's playing with math. Einstein called play the highest form of research. What a lovely thought. Let your students play with math. It gives them ownership of the problem. And as play, I mean, make it fun, make it enjoyable, make it into a game, make these story problems. Help them write story problems. That has been such an effective thing in my mind, for me. So we have this new math concept, and they're especially, so fractions, multiplying, whether you multiply or divide fractions, let's say, seems like a really complex thing for students. Have them say, you know what, I want you to write 3 story problems where you have to divide fractions, and write 3 story problems where you have to multiply fractions. And something changes in their mind when they try to think of how to write a problem that you'd have to divide fractions, and it makes it way easier for them. Super neat little trick. As they play with this math, they learn to understand the problem. They also learn to enjoy the journey. And ideally, they learn to enjoy and love math itself. There's many ways we can do this. So many games, math games involve geometry, and measuring and shapes and angles and interlocking things. And that's a fun thing, making art with math. Dividing things up according to measuring things. The butterfly wing he talked about, the proportions and the ratios, and make it fun. Make it real. We talked a little bit about the Muslims, how they didn't make art with faces or any physical thing. All of their art was strictly shapes and very mathematical. Fun to do that. Just saying. Really fun to do that. Find some of that art, learn how to do it, and help your students enjoy it as well. So many of the very great mathematical discoveries were made by people who were playing with math and enjoying it. I couldn't believe it. The more I read, you know, this guy, it's not sweating drops of blood in his study trying to finish his miserable homework. No, the guy is having fun, and he's discovering things, and he's And I think something happens when your brain is relaxed and you're enjoying some mathematical concept that it becomes beautiful. So we have some language barriers in math that I've seen a lot. Some people, the last number of years I've been teaching language. I've been teaching English to people who don't speak English. And it is the funnest thing you could ever imagine. Making noises, making sounds, making words work. But something happens. A large percentage of your class, if you're speaking to them and you say a new word, I've seen it happen so many times, a child, he'll be sitting there being focusing on you. Absolutely. There's no distractions, we're working, and you say a new word, and you see this tiny little glaze go over their eyes, as their brain, and your brain is a wonderful thing, this happens subconsciously, your brain takes this word and tries to put it into context. It scrambles through millions of possible meanings, trying to find a home for this word. And it happens subconsciously, the computers of your brains are far beyond miraculous. And as it's going through all of these computations, trying to find a home for this word, you go ahead and say the rest of your sentence, and they miss it all. Now, they were looking you in the eyes the whole time. They understood. I mean, they heard. Every word entered their ears. But the little librarian in their brain that is there to organize things was back there running through the dictionaries. You know? Never heard the rest of the sentence. Be very careful about that. And there's some ways to check on this. Happens so often in math class. Students are looking right at you. Their minds are trying to sort it. Some fixes for this. Slow down. Don't talk like I am talking in this class. Slow down much slower than you think you need to. And here comes the English teacher part of me. Say your words distinctly. and say the endings of your words. We tend to be pretty sloppy with our language. And children don't know all the words we use necessarily. We want to teach them, but if they don't understand this, we haven't taught them anything. So slow down, say your words distinctly, face your students when you speak. If you turn around to write on the chalkboard, if you're trying to explain a new concept, you're better off just stopping while you're writing and then turn around and talk again. Instead of just, especially if you have beards, I mean, in the you want to say your words distinctly while you're facing your students. Beards are amazing, though. They work better than non-beards. I mean, they might not. I don't know. Everything works, you know what, if you try. Okay. No, nothing about beards. Okay. As you're going along and teaching your math class, get feedback constantly from your students. You honestly, if you're teaching, and especially in younger grades, you really shouldn't go more than a minute or two without feedback from your students. Ask them a question. Keep them involved. If you find all of a sudden, and me as the talker, this is how I mess up, I all of a sudden find myself, you know what, I've been talking solid for 5 minutes, and they're getting that glazed look in their eyes. Don't find yourself there. Change that teaching style so you're asking them. You say a sentence or two, and then you ask them. You know, and you get feedback, and they finish the sentences, and just go sit in Jonathan Erb's classes and watch him teach. That's kind of how you want to do. Really, truly, get feedback constantly. Ask questions. Explain each new term. Make sure you define. Make sure you explain what you're doing, because they're going to be sit there without that word, a meaning for that word. They're going to be, but you understand that. Make sure your class is with you. So, we're talking again about foundations. We know that the foundations of mathematics, if they're not well laid well early on, the rest of their lives of math are going to be pretty miserable. So, teachers, do a ton of drill. Help them know their math facts. Honestly, as far as just plain old downright useful go, knowing your math facts is one of the most wonderful things you could ever do. It's a powerful, wonderful thing to live with. Know your math facts. Help them know their math facts. Review and recap, and have your students do that. Have them teach the review. Warn them the day before. Say, you know what, tomorrow we're going to have, I'm not sure which one of you, but one of you guys is going to come up here, and you're going to do a quick little, a 2-3 minute review on today's lesson, and I want you to re-explain it to your class. Sometimes if they're feeling a little snowed under, maybe you could assign one person so they're all not studying, but often, you know, let them be the review. If you feel like you're the teacher standing in front of your class trying to force your students to do review, you should maybe tweak the program just a little bit. And I've been there and done that. I'm like, I'm reviewing this. Don't you understand? This is going to be on your test. I'll do it one more time. You know what? No, actually, I'll do it another time after that. And you know what? We don't want to be in that situation. Have them, with the pressure on them to be reviewing and doing the review, but make sure the review gets done, because, so I have this theory after learning Bangla. So I did some formal learning of Bangla, and I would go sit underneath my teacher, I mean in front of my teacher, and he would teach me tremendously wonderful lessons in Bangla, and then he'd give me these vocabulary lists. And he was sort of a sadist, and so his lists were just massively long, and I had these, oh, know them by tomorrow. And so I would take them home, and I would study them, and flashcards, and oh my goodness, and I learned them really well. But I learned those flashcards really well. He could never catch me on a flashcard that I didn't know. But if I didn't make an effort and use those words in my everyday language, in a year from then, if I would go back and try to do those flashcards again, I would not know them. And you don't have to use them much, just a time or two. And my theory is this. I have absolutely no evidence to back this up except my own experience and watching my students. But your brain is this efficient house cleaner, in my own words, right? You feed it all this information, and you tell it it's important, but it doesn't believe a word you say. It's like my mom. You know what? I don't believe you need that. You know, and but it watches you. And if you use it, it moves it from the junk shelf onto the useful shelf. The shelf where, you know what, the guy used it, it made him happy, he did things with it, and it was a good, it was a useful thing. You know what, he used it in the last 6 months, he can have it, you know, that type of program. If you don't use it, I don't care how important you tell your mom it is, I mean your brain it is, it gets tossed. And so help your students use it. If you don't, help me out here. If you don't use it, you lose it. There you go. That's what I'm trying to say. Teach the math is something that you use. Okay, so now I want to do a little bit of math teaching. So I'm so excited about this. So, all of you math teachers. I have been, so I asked a number of teachers what their students struggle with. And I asked the lower grade teachers. Oh, I asked the upper grade teachers too, and I couldn't even understand their answers. So I went with the lower grade teachers' answers. And one thing that I found that was really kind of shocking to me is how many students struggle with place value. How to get this place value business in their heads. And so that's something that I struggle with, you know? So I have this little deal. Place value. So it helps if you do a little bit of a history of numbers and mathematics and how we didn't always have numbers and we had to match these things with stones. So in this blank, we understand what numbers mean. We understand that 5 equals like these simple numbers, and we're gonna say this in this box represents. This is gonna be your basic apple, and you'll notice this apple was like an apple grown in like North Carolina, where there's a lot of blights. It's not very round or straight. So we have your basic North Carolina apple, and not really known for apples in North Carolina. And whatever number you put in this blank equals that many apples. So we're going to say, if we put a 4 in here, that equals 4 apples, right? Super simple. If we put a 7 in there, equals 7 apples. And all goes well, but what if you have more than 9 apples, because you're never allowed to put 2 numbers in one of these blanks. So let's say we have 10 apples. Good thing is, we can draw more blanks. That's one of the rules. So in this blank, we have a little box of apples. And in this box of apples, there are 10 of them. There's some down inside you can't see. These are all apples and worms, leaves. Right, there's 10 apples in this box. Whatever number we put in this box is how many boxes of 10 apples there are. So, if we put in a 5, there are 5 boxes of 10 apples, which equals 50 apples total. And you can count on your fingers. And then whatever's in this box, you know, equals how many single apples, right? But if we have more than 9 boxes of apples, we can't put 10 in here, so we just add another blank. And you can keep going here. This is now a barrel of apples. Much of a barrel maker there. And this barrel has 100 of the little guys in it. It's just apple. Every number you put in this box, is how many barrels of apples. So if I put 4 in here, that means there's 4 barrels of 100 apples, right? And then next is a pickup truck full of apples. You know, and you go, you know, it's driving off. For 1,000 apples. You know what? But what if you don't have a whole apple? What if you're trying to count a piece of an apple that's smaller than a whole apple? Well, whenever you go into pieces of apples, you have to go beyond the decimal point. So put in this decimal point, and we made another little box here, and this is for apple pieces of apples that are smaller than a whole apple. So this first box is now, and it's nice if you have apples. Except that's actually a little distracting. Just drawing them on the board can help too. But apples can gauge your students as far as need goes. And in this thing, we have slices of apples. These are actually slices of apples. They're not just your basic B. So we have 10 slices in this first box, right? Every number we put in here is the amount of tenths of an apple that we have. So if I put one in here, that means there's one of these little pieces. If I put five in here, that means there's five of those pieces, right? What if our pieces are even smaller? Like, really, really weeny. What if we divide an apple into 100 pieces? And they're just up here like this. I mean, there's hundreds of them. There's apple pieces. And they're just tiny. And whatever we put into this blank, we have, is the amount of hundredths of apples that we have. So if we have two in here, that's only 2/100ths of an apple. Two hundredths of an apple. So right here, and the way you say this, by the way, and you can go into more depth with this, is 52/100ths, right? And you can explain how that works a little better. And we want to go to thousandths, you know. And that's the thousandths spot, right? And you have them tell you in pieces of apples when they don't understand. Make them draw this number. I don't understand this number. Well, I want you to draw this above the number, just like this. And eventually they won't have to draw it because it takes a little time and they'll figure it out, right? But you want them to understand what you're doing. And it's really simple. As you go this way, the pieces get smaller and smaller. And anything on this side of the line is pieces of apple. When you go this way, it gets bigger and bigger. And you just make it, you know what, it takes you, we sometimes don't teach some of these concepts because we think they're too simple. And we think you should just know that. And most of your students probably will. But honestly, at the end of the day, it takes you 3 minutes to teach it, 5 minutes to teach it, and it may actually make the difference with that student to be able to actually operate in this world of mathematics. Make it real. So another thing that I never understood, even in the foggiest part of my brain, was what happened when you divided fractions. How can you take two fractions? And I asked my teachers this. How can you take two fractions, these weeny little fractions, and you divide them, and you get a whole number often, a big number? How do you do that? That's impossible. It's like taking two little things and dividing them into smaller pieces and getting, like, big pieces. And my teacher's like, well, good question. I have no idea. And, of course, lazy me never went any farther than that. What happens when you divide fractions? So we should start with a question, right? And now I'll say this before I start. We divide fractions with a very simple algorithm. We switch the second fraction around the reciprocal of that number, and we divide. But that is an algorithm. That's not what's happening with the fraction. But what I would recommend you do is when you teach fractions, you first teach them simply this algorithm. And maybe a few days into it, when they've sort of got this, because there's a tendency when you have this girl, I'm not sure why I said girl, boy, this boy in your class who really struggles with mathematics, right? And you give them too much right away, they'll never, it becomes this gigantic mountain they'll never be able to cross. Oh, dividing fractions, oh no, he got into pies and shapes, and oh, please don't save me from the division of fractions. But if you teach them the algorithm, some of those students will just hang on to that, and simply, that's going to be good enough. But for some of your students, it'd be really nice if they knew what was happening. So first, I would teach them the simple algorithm, and then later on, I would show them what's happening. So, starting with the question, I have 3/4 of a pizza in the fridge. I would like to serve each of my friends 1/4 of a pizza. How many friends can I serve? Really, really simple. But let's draw it on the board so that these numbers aren't fractions. We want them to become pieces of pizza, right? Here's our pizza. And we divide it into 4 pieces, which is how pizzas should be divided. These weeny little slivers are like, what do you do with that, right? And these are all full. And you actually had a whole pizza, but on the way home from the Pizza Hut, you were hungry, and you know what? There's nothing but 2 crumbs or 3. And that piece is empty, right? So we have 3 pieces here. You wanted to invite some friends over, but you're not sure how many you can invite. So you want to do a little mathematics here. And you know what? We're not going to do any problems. We're just going to look at that. If I serve each of my friends 1/4 of a pizza, how many friends can I serve? 3.
three friends. I mean, that's really simple. Three. Don't ask dumb questions. So we can serve three friends, right? Guess what? We just did this right here. We did 3/4 divided by 1/4 equals 3, right? We didn't do anything on this problem. We just did a picture up here, right? Three friends, three free pieces. We got a big whole number after dividing our fractions. We found out how many quarter pieces, we found out how many 1/4 are in 3/4, right? Really simple.
So let's go on to what if we don't have the same amount of pieces. So let's say I have another pizza, right? And this pizza is a little different, new style, like this. And the guys who made this were real geniuses, and they divided it into thirds, right? Again, on the way home, you were struck with the hunger, and 1/3 is gone, right? Still have 2/3. But you realize that was actually a pretty big piece of pizza. I mean, you wouldn't need that much per friend. And you want to invite some friends over again, so you think, you know what? A sixth of a pizza would be enough for my friends. I mean, they're skinny anyway, or fat anyway, they don't need it, you know what I'm saying? So we have 2/3 of a pizza, we can see that. And we want to give each of our friends a sixth of a pizza. So we're going to want to divide that 2/3 into 1/6. And you're supposed to be letting your students do this. But I really wanted to give a few minutes for you guys to have some thoughts here, so I'm just kind of scrambling through some of this stuff. But we should be letting them sort of helping you find this way. So we have 2/3 divided by 1/6, right? So we have a problem here. If we want this pizza into 6, we're going to have to divide it into more pieces, right? We only have 2 pieces there. It was 3 pieces. We want to divide it now into 6 pieces. So what we're going to do is we're going to get out our scissors, and we're going to divide that pizza. Ka-chingo. And we have, instead of the original 3 pieces, minus 1 piece, we have 6 pieces, minus, no, these 2 pieces. See that? And so we can look at this picture, and we can see that I can feed 4 of my friends here with these, it used to be 2 pieces, 2/3. I can now feed 4 of my friends with the 6 of pieces. And then you show them that, guess what, a really simple way of doing this without drawing pictures, but maybe they should draw pictures periodically so that they understand what's happening, is we just go 2/3. Can you see over here? I'm so sorry. So sorry. That would help you out much. And when we divide like this, first, instead of doing it, we just erase that. We multiply times 6 over 1. We switch those around. And when you multiply this, we have 3. This is really awkward. And when we do this, it comes up to 4. Anyway, so that's how the dividing of fractions works. Okay, so that's how that works. Do any of you have any, there were some more things that I was thinking of teaching you, but I'm actually really glad I don't have to. Do you have anything that you would like to say quickly about tricks you've learned with the, you know what? When this class is over with, if you don't know how to use an abacus, get Larry Martin back here in the corner to show you. It's amazing. Truly amazing.
You can show them right now.
I could, but you know what? I'm not very good at these things. You showed it to me yesterday, and I held it in my head, and I did it a time or two, and now all of a sudden it looks overwhelming. Just to be real honest with you.
If your students have trouble figuring out which one to roll or which one to flip, I always tell them roll the right.
Roll the right. Very good. You know what? Very good. Make it simple. Make it memorable. Make it tie it with something they know. Roll the right. If you ever learn to navigate a boat in the ocean or otherwise, the only thing you have to remember is there's buoys out there, and they're red and green, and it's on either side of the channel, depends on whether you're going in or coming out. And the only thing you have to remember to navigate channels in the ocean is red, right, return. You keep the red on your right when you return. And of course, so then when you're going out, it's going to be on your left. So just remember you know, make it memorable just like he's doing here. Well, I have a little bit more here, like 2 seconds, maybe like 30 seconds. So, teach math well. Enjoy it, and teach your students to enjoy it as well. Teach them how math is the language of nature. It is the tool we use to put into words the curve of a waterfall or the hardness of a diamond. It is how we track the flight of a bird and measure the stars. But much more importantly, show them how math can be a doorway to God himself, a God who loves beautiful things, a God who established order and symmetry even in the wonder and vibrancy of his creation, an order we can glimpse as we study him with this language of mathematics, how he is a God we can trust, not only with the details, but also with the greatest problems of our lives. So as you teach math this year, use it to teach God. Show your students how the study of mathematics can let them glimpse the very fingerprints of God. God bless you so very much as you teach him this year in your classroom. You are dismissed.